New York City. The bar was a rat hole. The lighting was mercifully dim, but you could still see the knife scars in the wooden bar, the posters mostly of mostly naked women perched in various poses on Harley-Davidson motorcycles. The bartender was 6.5 feet tall, probably weighed 300 pounds. He had tattoos all over what was visible of his body. Lined up at the bar and seated at the tables were other bikers, men and women, and none of them looking what you would call wholesome. On a raised platform off to one side of the bar, red and blue lights played over a listless dancer. She was naked and as erotic as a chunk of concrete. Nobody was watching the woman dance. Jay Gridley, wearing a sleeveless blue denim jacket sporting colors from the Thai Tigers Motorcycle Club, TTMC superimposed over a growling tiger's face, stood between two bruisers a foot taller than he, and probably half again his weight. One of the bruisers accidentally tapped Jay with his elbow. "Watch it," Jay said. The biker turned, death in his eyes, but when he saw Jay, he blinked and said, "Sorry, man." Jay grinned. Well, what the hell? It was his scenario, wasn't it? Jay knew he had the moves to wipe up the virtual floor with anybody in the place. And even in VR, people could sense a real expert from his moves and stance. The bartender came over and Jay pointed at his empty glass. The giant nodded, pulled a bottle of tequila off the shelf. When he poured, the worm sloshed into the glass with the fiery liquid. He looked at Jay. Jay shrugged. "Leave it. It adds texture." The bartender started to turn away. Jay said, "I'm looking for somebody."
"Yeah?"
He locked gazes with Jay. "Yeah, a shooter." He pulled the smudged drawing from his jacket pocket. This was the composite put together by the computer artist based on the harp guard's description of Dick Grayson. The bartender never took his gaze from Jay's.
"Don't know him, ain't seen him."
"Look at the picture."
"Don't need to. Won't matter."
"So that's how it is?"
"Yeah, that's how it is."
Jay grabbed the bartender by a clump of chest hair and jerked him against the edge of the bar. With his free hand, he pulled an automatic knife with a 5-inch blade from his jeans. He put the point against the bartender's throat. In the real world, Jay had grabbed the home address of the guy playing bartender and force-fed the generating computer a virus-laced cookie. If he didn't pull the knife away, the guy's system was going to go belly up in about 10 seconds after he cut him. "Look at the picture, or I give you a new smile."
"Okay, don't get twitchy."
The bartender glanced down at the image. Jay grinned. This visit to a mercenary chat room on VR was a lot more interesting than running facial points of comparison against the image files of the NCIC, NAPC, or the FBI image files, looking for a match, which he had already done and come up with zero.
"Yeah, I seen him," the bartender said. "He's been in once or twice."
"Where can I find him?"
"I don't know. But the guy over by the pool table, the one in the army shirt drinking Boilermakers, he's had some dealings with him."
Jay nodded. But the man who enjoyed dropping a shot glass of whiskey into his beer stein, depth charge style, wasn't really there. He was a proxy. While it was true that none of the people in the ersatz biker bar were really there, some were less so than others. A proxy was a shell, little more than a link to another location, something to mark a place, and not somebody you could interface with directly. Jay was able to get a location, but a quick pulse in that direction did a reverb with nothing more than a RW street address, somewhere in the district. Apparently, Mr. Boilermaker here didn't like to reveal too much on the net, and if Jay wanted to speak with him, he was going to have to drop out of VR and go RW. He wasn't a field op. He was a net jet. So he could pass this along to one of the staff investigators to have them look up Boilermaker here and have a face-to-face chat with him. Jay shook his head. That might take days, even if the boss put a rush on it. Jay didn't altogether trust the shoe skidders, and it would be his luck to get a dull one who'd mess up the interview. Saji had been after him to get out more. No reason why he couldn't drop by and do the interview himself, was there? It wasn't as if he was afraid of going outside. He headed for the door. As he reached the exit, the exotic dancer's music changed and the first notes of Destroyer's version of Bad to the Bone rumbled its bass beat from the speakers. Jay grinned.
For a second, he'd forgotten he'd programmed that in.
Yep.
That's me. Jay Gridley better not step into my path, because I'm bad. Woodland Hills, California. Ventura wiped a thin film of sweat from his forehead as he stood outside the theater, smiling into the parking lot. It was probably almost 80 degrees, and it was not yet 9 a.m. He and Morrison had been here for almost 2 hours, and of course his people had been in place since before Wu had called yesterday. The regular staff had been given 3 days off with pay and told that a special training session for employees of a different theater was being conducted. Only a fool would choose a neutral meeting place if he could pick one that would tilt the playing field in his favor. Within 3 hours of the call, Chinese agents had put the theater under surveillance, and a couple of them had tried to con their way inside. Ventura's people had kept the place secure, though they couldn't do anything about the watchers outside. Still, Ventura knew they had the advantages. He had chosen the time and place, he controlled the building, and they needed Morrison alive, whereas Ventura could pot anybody on their side he wanted. And when it got right down to it, he was pretty sure he was better at strategy and tactics than Chili Wu. Ego, and no way around that. But Ventura had come to terms with his ego a long time ago. Yes, he had to accept that there were likely better assassins out there now than he was, younger, stronger, faster. But he was pretty sure that Chili Wu wasn't one of them. If the deal went smoothly, well and good. But if things went sour, well, then they'd see. They'd dance the dance, and then they'd know for sure. He smiled as he headed back toward the theater. Morrison stood by the concession stand, nervously sucking on a straw stuck in a cup of fizzy orange drink. He's going to ask me if everything's okay, Ventura thought. Everything okay? Ventura smiled. Under control. You aren't worried at all? Wouldn't a hidden metal detector or X-ray be wise? No point. I figure they'll try to slip a minimum of 8 men in with Wu, a maximum of 12. I am assuming they will all be armed. I have 20 men. Remember, the idea here is not to get into a shooting match, but to keep the balance of power even. It's our place, and Wu knows that. If he gets his people in, he'll be a lot more comfortable. If he couldn't get them in, then it might make him twitchy, and that's not what we want. No? No. A nervous man might do something rash. What we want is a nice, smooth negotiation in which the Chinese get what they want and you walk away a rich man. Everybody's happy. A nice win-win situation. But if they try something, they won't live to regret it, Doctor. Then we have to start all over again with a new negotiating team. Nobody wants that. But secretly, a small part of Ventura wanted exactly that. Come on, Wu. Show me what you got. Reach for your pocket and let's see who goes home. Quantico, Virginia. Michael stopped at Jay's office but didn't see him. He saw instead one of the techs, Ray DeCamp. The man always wore thick, round computer glasses, so of course he had the nickname appropriate to that. Hey, Owl. Jay around?
Commander? Nah. He said he had to go into town. Said he'd be back in a couple of hours.
That surprised Michaels. Jay seldom left during the day for any reason. Oh, well. Given everything else going on around here lately, Jay leaving the building during the day was no weirder than the rest of it.
Hey, Alex.
He looked up and refocused on Tony.
Hey.
You want to talk to me?
He nodded.
Yeah.
Come on, we can go to my office. Kind of stuffy there. How about the gym?
He had the smile. His office, his advantage. The gym was where she was stronger.
Why don't we go to the conference room instead?
She smiled back at him, and he knew she understood what he'd been thinking, what they had both been thinking.
God, he loved smart women.
Washington, D.C.
Maybe this wasn't such a good idea coming here, Jay thought. Here was a kind of Army-Navy surplus store.
The whole place had a sour odor, like unwashed cotton socks mixed with damp wool, And instead of air conditioning, a pair of large and loud metal fans mounted on 7-foot-tall posts circulated the too warm and fetid air without doing much to cool it or the people inside. Some of the patrons looked familiar. Maybe Jay had seen their pictures on the post office's most wanted website, and none of them were what you would call savory. Still, he was Jay Gridley, a master scenarist. He'd built uglier scenarios in VR. The guy perched on the stool behind the counter next to the old-style mechanical cash register was the least appetizing character in the place. He was fat, bald, and wore an eye patch made of what looked like rattlesnake skin over his right eye, and vaguely green army-style fatigues that had probably been unwashed since the Spanish-American War.
What can I do for you?
You Vince Fiscus?
That would be me, yeah. And who wants to know?
I'm Jay Gridley. I called earlier.
Jay pulled his NetForce ID card. Fiscus looked at it carefully.
All right. What's it about, Mr. NetForce agent?
Jay kind of liked the sound of that. He tendered the picture of the mystery man.
You know this guy?
Fiscus looked at the picture. He grinned, showing a gap where a front eye tooth had once been.
That's OKS. Sure, I know him.
Jay felt a sudden surge of excitement.
Aha, gotcha.
KS?
Yeah. Stands for Killer Spook. Ain't seen him for a while, and he never gave me a real name, so I just called him KS.
How is it that you know him?
Oh, he's been coming around for must be 5-6 years now. What are you looking for him for? He's not into computer stuff.
I am not at liberty to say. It concerns an ongoing investigation. Why Killer Spook?
Fiscus showed the tooth gap again.
I asked around some people I know. Rumor was this guy made a living doing odd jobs for various folks, including a few government ones. Black bag ops, wet work stuff you don't want to show up in the books, you know what I mean?
Where might I find him?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you why you need him again,
Fiscus said. Like I said, I can't tell you that.
You want to bet?
Fiscus raised his whiskey-soaked voice a couple of notches.
Vic? Rudy? Come here.
Two fairly young men in green-on-green camouflage shirts and pants tucked into gleaming combat boots seemed to materialize from nowhere behind Jay. The pair of them were huge, 500, maybe 600 pounds combined.
Uh-oh.
Jay had seen enough vids to know he was maybe in a little trouble here. He was alone, unarmed, and it looked as if he was about to make the unwilling acquaintance of Vic and Rudy. Jay looked at Fiscus and saw that the man held a big dark metal pistol.
Take your hands away from your belt and put them where I can see them.
He waved the pistol. Jay had another sudden flash. The only reason Fiscus had told him any of this stuff about the man he'd come looking for was because he didn't expect Jay was going to be able to act on it or tell anybody else. He had seen a lot of vids. Jay suddenly had a vacuum in his belly. This was not VR. He couldn't just axe a command and drop back into his office. That gun was real. He was turned slightly so Fiscus couldn't see his right hip. He double-triple-pressed the panic button on his Virgil. 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Then slowly moved his hands away from his body.
Take it easy, Jay said. Let's be reasonable here.
That's real good, Mr. Agent. Now, let's mosey on into the back room and have ourselves a little talk, eh?
Woodland Hills, California. Morrison leaned against the counter in the bathroom, staring at himself in the mirror. It was as if he was seeing a stranger. He washed his hands, bent and rinsed out his mouth. He had the little gun in his sport coat pocket, but the small weight of it bumping against his right hip was not comforting. He was scared, frightened to the point where all he wanted to do was to take off at full speed and run until he couldn't keep going. Ventura came around the corner behind him and Morrison jumped.
Wu just pulled up. You ready?
Yes. As ready as I can be.
Don't worry. Every one of Wu's people will have somebody watching him. We have this covered.
Despite just washing out his mouth, it was dry again.
Listen,
he said. There's something I want you to know. I have a hidden copy of the data. If something happens to me, I want you to have it. Sell it, give it away, whatever you want, I don't care, but sell it to anybody but the Chinese.
Nothing is going to happen to you.
I believe you, but just in case. This is the only original research I've ever done that amounted to anything. It's important work. I don't want to see it lost.
If it makes you feel better, fine. I'll see that it gets to a good home.
It's not here, he said. The copy.
All right. Where is it?
Morrison told him. When he was done, Ventura smiled.
That's pretty clever.
Maybe the Pakistanis. They hate the Chinese. They'd find a use for it.
This is all moot. I can guarantee you the Chinese will not be walking out of this theater with you as their hostage. At the first sign of trouble, they will all become past tense. This is what I do, Patrick.
Morrison took a ragged breath. All right. The movie wasn't scheduled to start for another 30 minutes, but it was definitely showtime. Quantico, Virginia. Tony had planned to sit down and tell Alex what she felt, to apologize for losing her temper, and to try to get him to see her side of things. It seemed like it would work out, because the first thing he said was,
"Listen, I'm sorry about losing my temper."
That was a great start. She said,
"Me too."
But that was as far as it got. Alex's secretary opened the conference room's door and said, "Commander, we just got a distress call from Jay Gridley's Virgil."
"What?"
"District police are on the way. Here is the location." Alex came to his feet.
"This place is falling apart. Nothing is going right."
He looked at her.
"You coming?"
She nodded. Washington, D.C.
"Hit him again,"
Fiscus said. Rudy nodded. He threw a short uppercut that slammed into Jay's belly like a steel brick. Jay doubled over, the pain overwhelming. He couldn't breathe, couldn't see for the tears clouding his vision, couldn't believe how much it hurt. He would have fallen if Vic hadn't been standing behind him, holding him up. Nothing in VR had ever come close to this, nothing.
"Catch your breath, Mr. Net Force Agent, and think about it a second."
Jay managed to breathe again after a few seconds.
"You feel better? Good. Now tell me, why are you looking for KS?
How long had he been here? It felt like years, but it couldn't have been more than a couple of minutes.
"Fuck you. You're not my type, but maybe Rudy will take you up on that later, hey? Boys, girls, sheep, cows, doesn't matter to him. One more, Rudy."
Jay went out with the third punch, at least partially. The intense flash of pain went from red to gray, and time seemed to ooze lazily like tar on a hot summer street.
"Got all day,"
Fiscus said.
"And Rudy ain't even broke a sweat. I seen him work the heavy bag for 10-15 minutes, 400-500 punches. You ain't a bag full of batting, son. How long you figure you'll last?"
Jay knew that Fiscus and his two apes could and might beat him to death.
Okay, I'll tell you." "Shit," Rudy said.
Jay took a raspy breath. The guy didn't know, so it didn't matter what he said. Jay could create scenario. He could spin it, and how would this guy know different?
"Okay. We came across a computer break-in in New York. A stock trading company and..." "Rudy."
The punch took Jay under the armpit on the right side, and he felt and thought he heard one of his ribs crack under the impact.
Ow. What did you do that for? I'm telling you." "No, you ain't. You're lying. I might look stupid, but I didn't fall off the turnip truck yesterday, kid. Every lie buys you another slam. Try again."
Jay felt a great wave of despair wash over him. He was going to die. He knew it. No matter what he told them, in the end, they were going to kill him. Washington, D.C.
"That's it, the surplus store," the cop said.
In the big tactical van, Michaels nodded. According to the protocols for Net Force distress calls established with the police, the local cops had arrived code 2, fast but without sirens. They set up a perimeter, and the local version of SWAT or CERT or whatever was ready to go in, but Michaels had gotten there before they hit the building, and he wanted to go along. The police lieutenant in charge of the scene looked at Michaels' taser and shook his head. Not a good idea, Commander. We know who this guy is that runs the store. We're pretty sure he's got enough illegal hardware in there to equip a Third World Army, and he's usually not alone. Your little zapper won't cut it.
I'll stay behind the team. That's my man in there. I'm going too, Tony said. She held her own taser.
What is this, a goddamn parade? Where's the marching band and the baton twirlers?
I can make some calls, Lieutenant, and get the heavy hitters into it if I have to. You want me to do that?
Shit, no. Put masks and vests on and stay in the back and the hell out of the way. You understand? If you get killed, don't bitch about it to me.
Alex looked at Tony. This was not the time to tell her to stay behind. He could see that, but it was the first thing he wanted to say. Maybe she was right. Maybe she couldn't work for him. Maybe he was too protective. He did not want her in there.
Heads up, people, the lieutenant said into his comm. We're going in 30 seconds, and we got two feebs riding the caboose. Don't nobody shoot them by accident.
The lieutenant pulled a pair of spider silk vests with ceramic interlock armor and the initials DCPD stenciled in reflective yellow on the backs.
Put these on. They'll stop handgun rounds and a lot of rifle bullets. Grab a gas mask and helmet. We're going in with flashbangs and puke gas.
Michaels nodded. He glanced at Tony and they jumped from the back of the mobile command post and ran. Woodland Hills, California. Morrison and Ventura were in their seats in the theater when an usher walked Wu down the aisle. The section they were in had been roped off, so they sat in the middle of a block of four rows alone. The other seats in the block were all empty. There were maybe 40 people already in their seats, with a few others trickling in. Wu carried a fold-out laptop computer slung over one shoulder, and a big tub of popcorn. Ventura smiled at that. Had to give the man credit for style. Ventura and Morrison both stood, and Wu held up the tub of popcorn. Want some? I think it's got real butter on it. It should be real. It cost $4. Ventura was tempted to dig around and see if there was a pistol hidden there. He'd have a small one under the popcorn, but both he and Morrison declined the offer. What time does the movie start?
We have a few minutes, Ventura said.
Good, good. We can get this business taken care of and enjoy the picture. It's gotten good reviews. Now, you know we Chinese like to dawdle and make polite small talk before we discuss business, but this is America, and I like to fit in, so what say we get down to it?
He slipped the computer off his shoulder and unrolled the flexible pop-up LCD screen, then unfolded the keyboard. The computer came on. Morrison's computer was already up and running on the seat on the other side of him. He picked it up.
Ah, here we are, Wu said.
Your bank account number? Morrison read off a 15-digit series of numbers and letters. Wu typed it into his computer. He looked up at Morrison and smiled. And that was for $300 million U.S.?
$400 million, Morrison said quickly.
A small joke, doctor. He tapped in the numbers. There you are, Dr. Morrison. You should see it on your machine. Morrison tapped keys.
Yes, it's in and verified.
He typed in another sequence. The account number and password are both changed.
Then you have it. We can deposit, but we can't take it back. You're a rich man.
Now it's your turn. Morrison nodded. He still looked like a man sitting in an electric chair waiting for the current to flow. Here is the address for our people, Wu said. He held the computer up so Morrison could see the screen. You send them the data. They say they can have it tested in less than 2 hours. They work. We watch the movie. Everybody goes home happy.
Morrison nodded and started to type in the electronic address.
Gun!
Somebody screamed, and sure enough, guns started to go off. Washington, D.C.
Tony was right behind Alex when the first of the six-man team ahead of them crashed through the door into the back room of the surplus store. Bright flashes of actinic light strobed her. A misty cloud of green-gray vapor boiled up with the explosions and lapped against the walls with the racket. She heard a triplet of quick, smaller explosions, pap, 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 gunshots, she was sure, and Alex dogleg to the left. She followed him. Somebody retched so loudly it sounded as if he was turning his guts inside out. Alex looked back at her.
You okay?
Yes, I'm fine. Then it was all over. The mist, which felt greasy on her bare skin, started to clear, and the police team spread out enough so Tony could see four men who weren't cops. Three of them were on their hands and knees vomiting. One was on his back, blood oozing from holes in his side and one leg. He had his head sideways, and he was throwing up too. One of the men on his knees enjoying the purging benefits of emetic gas was Jay Gridley. Thank God, Tony said into the mask. The sound was muffled, but she saw Alex nod. Woodland Hills, California. Wu was quick. He dropped from his seat onto the sticky floor and tossed the tub of popcorn into Ventura's face as he fell. Wu came up with a gun. It must have been underneath the popcorn tub, and jammed it at Ventura. He fired twice. The bullets hit Ventura square in the chest, but the titanium trauma plate in the pocket of the blended Kevlar spider silk vest under his shirt stopped the rounds, even though they felt like sledgehammers against his sternum. Ventura cleared his own weapon and brought it around. Morrison was up and running, screaming wordlessly. Wu cursed and got off another round, higher this time, right on the edge of the trauma plate. More gunshots blasted in the theater. One-handed, Ventura fired, one, two, three, letting the recoil raise the muzzle each time so the shots walked up Wu's body in case he was also wearing a vest, so the hits were chest, throat, head. Stop! 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 Morrison screamed. Ventura looked up from Wu, saw that Morrison had his own little .22 revolver out and pointed in front of himself as he reached the aisle. One of Ventura's best shooters, the ex-SEAL Blackwell, moved to grab Morrison, to pull him down and out of the line of fire. Good, good. But Morrison was panicked, and he thrust his weapon out at the man. Morrison, no! Ventura screamed. Don't! Too late. Morrison pulled the trigger. Blackwell coming to save the scientist was 5 feet away, and even Morrison couldn't miss every time at that range. At least two or three of the six shots chewed into Blackwell. The vest he wore stopped a couple, but one went high, hit him in the jaw, and Ventura saw a tooth explode from the torn mouth in slow motion as Blackwell's head jerked to one side. Ah, shit! And he saw with razor-edged and expanded clarity as Blackwell did what any really good trained shooter instinctively did if somebody pointed a gun at him when the situation went hot. No! Ventura screamed. Blackwell knew Morrison was wearing a vest, and Blackwell didn't want to die. So even as he fell, wounded, Blackwell lined his pistol up on Morrison and stopped the threat. He shot him right between the eyes. Washington, D.C. He was going to be okay, Jay realized. The doctor had taped him up, given him a shot to counteract the puke gas and another for pain. Every breath he took still hurt his ribs, but he was real happy to be feeling anything at all. It was sure better than the alternative. The boss said, "What on earth possessed you to go into the field on your own?" Jay started to shake his head, but that made him dizzy, so he stopped. "I don't know. Pure stupidity would be my best guess. Not ever gonna happen again, I guarantee that. Reality sucks." They were in the hospital's lock ward, where one-eyed Fiscus had been transferred after they'd patched him up. He'd been hit twice after firing at the cops, in the side and in the leg. He was awake, and the boss had flexed his net force muscle to get in and question the guy. Jay and Tony were with Michaels as he walked into the room. "We want some information," Michaels said to Fiscus. Full of IV tubes, Fiscus flashed his gap-toothed grin.
"People in hell probably want ice water, too. Which you'll find out all about if you don't tell me what I want to know. Way I figure it, you have kidnapping, assaulting a federal officer, attempted murder of a policeman, and a shitload of illegal weapons charges staring you in the face at the very least. A man your age, you're going to die in prison.
And so why the fuck should I help you? I'm gonna die in prison anyhow.
It's real simple. I can make the federal charges go away. No kidnapping, no assault, no visits from the BATF about all that hardware. I might even be able to convince the locals to cut you some slack on the shooting since you didn't hit anybody. You could be out in 5, 6 years, maybe. Fiscus hesitated for a moment.
I'll take the deal. What do you want to know?
Woodland Hills, California.
What a mess, Ventura said to himself again. He was on the freeway with the same name as his own, driving in the general direction of Burbank.
What a fucking mess. And it was, too. Back in the theater were 10 shot-up Chinese agents, all of them either dead or well on the way by now. Two of his men had taken stray bullets from the Chinese, but neither were fatal wounds. 4 screenwriters had been hit. One was dead, another one pretty bad, 2 fairly minor. Blackwell was in bad shape, but he'd probably live. Wu was absolutely dead. And Morrison was also gone, killed by somebody on his own side. What a pisser that was. The wounded civilians were being hauled by cars to the nearest hospital, where they'd be dropped off, the drivers not staying to answer questions. Ventura's men would be taken to a doctor who was paid to take care of people and keep his mouth shut. The remaining unwounded screenwriters, 23 of them, had been stuffed into a storeroom and locked in. Probably half of them were already working on their next movie, one involving a shootout in a theater. Everybody else had taken off on prearranged escape routes.
I never should have given Morrison that gun.
Yeah. 20/20 hindsight there. Too late to think about that now. Though there never would be a way to be absolutely sure, Ventura knew what had happened. One of the Chinese agents had gotten careless. Since he knew his own people were more adept than to show a gun that was supposed to be hidden. Whichever of his people who saw the piece must have felt it was being brought into play. The shout of gun had been the agreed-upon signal for his shooters to take out their targets, and once that happened, all bets were off. Well, done was done. No point in crying over it now. Still, there were consequences to consider. The Chinese were going to be most unhappy, and they might well decide that Morrison and Ventura had ripped them off for their $400 million and decide to try and get it back, and that was real bad. Morrison wasn't going to be giving anything back, and Ventura didn't have it. Well, the first thing was, the couple of million he had tucked away didn't seem like all that much money anymore. The way he figured it, he was going to have to disappear, just as he had told Morrison he would have to disappear. Forever. If the deal had come off, he'd have been safe enough from the likes of Wu. But it hadn't come off. The Chinese were out that money. This is certainly going to make them real unhappy. Morrison hadn't given Ventura the account number, so he couldn't get his hands on it either. Too bad for everybody. The Chinese money was out of reach, but there was more where that had come from. Because Morrison had told him where to find the secret that had caused more than 12 people to die. And the Chinese weren't the only oysters in the ocean who had pearls. Somebody could still benefit from all this, and it might as well be him. He drove toward the airport in Burbank. He knew what he was going to do. Quantico, Virginia. I just got a call from Julio Fernandez, Jay said. John Howard is home.
That was quick, Tony said.
Michaels nodded at her.
Yeah?
Old soldiers never die, but they don't hang out in hospitals tempting fate if they can help it. They were in the conference room at HQ.
All right. Let's review what we have. According to your Mr. Fiscus, the man we are looking for used to be some kind of freelance hired assassin who supposedly got out of that business and into bodyguarding a few years back. Aside from Dick Grayson, he uses a variety of names, among them Diego, Gabriel, Harbor, Colorado, and Ventura.
Is he Hispanic, do we think?
Jay laughed, then said, ow! He pressed his hand against his sore rib. What?
I shouldn't laugh. I don't think he's necessarily Hispanic or Latino, boss. Those are all names of Los Angeles freeways.
Michaels nodded. Okay. So he knows about Batman and the SoCal highway system. What else do we have?
Zip. I looked in the phone directories, Jay said. He ain't listed, and we haven't been able to get a facial point match on any police agency computers. Man has a very low E-profile.
Michaels looked at Tony. He had to ask. You're going to take the job with the mainstream, aren't you? Working for the director?
Yes.
So is the information flow going to be both ways?
That's what the job description says.
Okay. See what you can get from them on this. If they could find out who this Ventura character was, if they could background and history him, they might be able to track him down. And if they found him, they'd find Morrison. The intercom blipped. Yes?
His secretary said, Sir, we have an incoming call from the director for Tony Fiorella.
Michaels frowned. He waved to Tony, who picked up the handset on the table.
Yes, ma'am?
The director said something, and Tony nodded.
Yes, ma'am. I have decided.
She glanced at Michaels.
I'll take it.
His gut twisted a little at that, but she was a grown woman. She had to make her own choices.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Tony listened for what seemed like a long time.
I see. Yes, I'll tell them. Yes, ma'am. I'm glad to be on board.
She cradled the phone, looking disturbed. What?
Michael said. Sheriff's deputies in Woodland Hills, California, were called to a disturbance at a movie theater there a few minutes ago. Inside, they found more than a dozen bodies, all shot dead, plus a locked storeroom full of screenwriters.
Corpses and a room full of screenwriters? This concerns us how? Jay put in.
One of the bodies was ID'd as a man named Chan Ho Wu, a registered foreign lobbyist who the FBI counter-espionage unit has tagged as a probable spy for China.
Uh-huh.
One of the bodies has been identified as Dr. Patrick Morrison.
Oh, shit, Jay said. But that solves our problem, doesn't it? Dead men don't generate radio broadcasts.
Tony said it before Michaels had a chance to say it. You're assuming he didn't tell anybody how he did it before he died.
Michaels tapped the comm. Get me on the next flight going to Los Angeles.
You're not a field agent, Alex.
But I
can't, Tony said. He said,
cutting him off.
The FBI will take care of this. You
can't. Portland got zapped with some kind of death ray. The leader of my strike teams is in bed nursing a gunshot wound. And my top computer whiz just got the crap beat out of him, not to mention I had the guy responsible for all of this in my hands, and I let him walk away. This has been a foobar from the word go.
You didn't know, but I know now.
You want to tell your new boss I'm overstepping my bounds? Fine, go ahead. I can take some vacation days myself if I have to.
You don't have to, she said. And if you want, I'll go with you.
He considered his next words carefully. He considered not saying anything, but decided he needed to. This is NetForce's problem, Tony, and I think NetForce should take care of it.
She blinked at him. And I'm not part of NetForce anymore, is that what you're saying?
You said it, not me.
She nodded. I see.
He didn't like the way it made him feel. Didn't like the distress on her face. But it was going to come out eventually, and better sooner than later. Tony had made her choice. Now they both have to live with it. Quantico, Virginia. Tony went to the small gym to work off the tension and anger she felt. There was a guy in steel-rimmed glasses, a t-shirt and bike shorts, doing hatha yoga in the corner. Otherwise, the place was empty. She hurried through her own stretching routine, bowed in, and began practicing jurus, working the triangle, the tiga. Half an hour later, when she was done, she started footwork exercises on the square, lankas on the sliwa. The moves were there, automatic after so many years, but her mind was elsewhere. Alex was upset with her, that was obvious. Well, what had she expected? That he would smile and pat her on the head and offer his congratulations? She tried to see it from his viewpoint, but she knew she couldn't have it both ways, not this time. This was the best thing.
Working for him had become a sore point even before they had gone to London. He wasn't treating her like he did the other members of the Net Force team. He was shielding her, and she didn't want that. Not in the work. So, okay, there was going to be an uncomfortable period while he adjusted to her new job. She didn't like it, but that was how it seemed to be working out.
In the long run, she kept telling herself, it would be better for them. They'd be able to relate to each other more like equals. The personal relationship wouldn't be bogged down in the professional one.
Yeah, but in the long run, we're all dead, aren't we? So what happens after a couple months of nobody having a good time if you or Alex get hit by a bus crossing the street? How is that going to fit in with your long-run plan, hmm?
Tony stopped moving and stared into the mirror at the end of the room.
Crap, I really don't need this.
But what help was there for it? What else could she do? She had to make a living. She sighed, went back to her footwork. A few minutes later, she was aware that the yoga guy had finished his routine and left, but that he'd been replaced by a trio of other men. Two of them were in karate uniforms. The third wore dark blue FBI sweats. One of the karate guys wore a brown cloth belt tied around his waist to keep his gi shut, the other a black belt. They were watching her, watching and smiling. Then the guy in sweats leaned over and said something to the other two. Pentjaksilat wasn't a flashy art. A lot of what went on in it didn't look particularly impressive to the uninitiated. The last time a martial arts player from another style stood here and watched her practice, he had made the mistake of making some ignorant remarks out loud. She had been having a bad day when that happened. Not nearly as bad as this one. And she had demonstrated to the loudmouth that what she was doing was in many ways superior to what he knew about fighting. It had been a painful lesson for the man. The lesson she had learned was pretty painful, too. She didn't want to think about what had happened with, and to, that man later, but she couldn't avoid it. Rusty had become her student, then her lover, however briefly, and as a direct result, he was dead. Given the day so far, the opportunity to offer a correction to any or all of these three if they spouted off would feel pretty good. It wasn't part of a self-defense mindset to entertain such thoughts. But Silat wasn't primarily a self-defense art. It was a fighting art, and there was a big difference in your level of aggressiveness. Tony stopped what she was doing and walked toward the trio. "Afternoon," she said. "Can I help you with something?" The guy in sweats was oldest of the three men. He had short and curly gray hair. He smiled and gave her a short bow. "No, ma'am," he said. "We were just admiring your art, guru." "Silat Jamande." That surprised her. He got the subset wrong, but he knew it was Silat, and he had enough appreciation and understanding to call her guru as well. "Damn. It's Serak. But it's Western Javanese, like Jamande. I'm surprised you recognized it."
"I used to work out with an old Dutch Kung Dao teacher in San Diego. He had done a little training in Silat as a boy. My JKD teacher also had some training in Harimau, tiger style."
Tony nodded. JKD, Jeet Kune Do, the way of the intercepting fist, was the style created by the late Bruce Lee. It was a hybrid system. And while they weren't big on forms, many of the moves were based on Wing Chun, which to some people looked at least superficially like Silat. At least the WC players knew in theory where the center line was, even if they didn't cover it adequately, according to Serak standards. If Curly here knew enough to recognize and respect what she was doing, he probably wouldn't be interested in trying to deck her to impress his friends. Silat fighters didn't go in much for point sparring, and for that matter, neither did JKD players. Well, too bad. Kicking somebody's butt would feel pretty good about now. And she was going to have to do something, or she would explode. But what could she do? Woodland Hills, California. It was dark by the time Michaels got to the theater, and there really wasn't much left to look at by then. Truth was, there really wasn't any good reason for him to be there. The bodies had been removed, the screenwriters released after giving their statements, and the local police still puzzled as to what had happened. The mainline FBI op who showed up to meet Michaels was a junior man,
Not the special agent in charge, but he was willing to say what he thought. His name was Dixon. "Here's what we know," Dixon said. "The dead men, all 13 of them, were shot in the theater proper. We have identification on 6 so far. None of them got a shot off, though some of the other dead men did fire their weapons. Morrison's gun, a little 22, was locked in his right hand in a death grip and shot empty. Nobody got hit with a 22 that we can tell. We haven't come up with IDs on the other dead men yet, but all of them had guns, too." Michael said, "So what do you think happened here?" "No way to tell for sure. The dead guys were mostly shot in the back or back of the head, so what it looks like is some kind of ambush. You have to figure that if you have a dozen armed men, most of whom didn't do any shooting before they got taken down, there were a lot of other guys in here blasting away, too. Forensic hasn't gotten the blood all sorted out, but a quick prelim says there were a few who got hit hard enough to bleed, but who didn't stick around."
"Jesus. We'd take his help if he offered.
You must have some ideas. You got anything for us?" Michael's thought about it. Tony would tell the director anyway. It was her job now, so it didn't matter if Dixon knew.
"Morrison had some kind of valuable data, and he used it against the Chinese. We think maybe they were after him. Maybe they caught up with him."
"What kind of data?"
"Sorry, that's need to know only."
Dixon shook his head. "Doesn't seem right. The dead guys were all sitting down when the shooting started. And according to the interviews with the screenwriters, everything was quiet until somebody yelled gun, at which point all hell busted loose. Sounds more like a negotiation than a face-off." Michaels considered what Dixon had said. A negotiation. Yes, it did, didn't it? Why would the Chinese be negotiating with a man who had wiped out a couple of their villages? Maybe they wanted him to tell them how. Maybe they were willing to pay for it. Paris, France.
Jay sat slouched in a wicker chair at the Café Mille, looking out on the Champs-Élysées, not far from the Arc de Triomphe. He sipped black, bitter espresso from a tiny china cup and smiled at the couples who strolled past. The war was over nearly 2 years, the Nazi occupation history. Post-war Paris in the spring was a much nicer place than a military surplus store in any season. Henri, the waiter, approached. He had in his hand a small paper tablet. He gave Jay a nod that was both servile and arrogant and offered him the tablet.
"Here is the list you wanted, Monsieur Gridley."
"Merci." Jay took the tablet and waved Henri away. He looked at the list, scanned down the row of names. No, no, no.
"Wait!"
Jay sat upright, bumped the table, and sloshed espresso from the cup.
Yes! There it was.
He snapped his fingers loudly, caught Henri's attention.
"Garçon, voulez-vous bien m'indiquer où se trouve le téléphone? Je désire appeler faire."
Henri rewarded Jay with a sneer.
"Better you should work on the pronunciation and the grammar first, monsieur."
The arrogant prick knew he wanted to make a call, but he had to correct his French first.
"Montrez du doigt, asshole."
Henri shrugged off the insult and did as Jay requested. He pointed toward the café. Jay stood and hurried to find the phone. Woodland Hills, California. Michaels had supper at the hotel, and when room service brought him the chicken sandwich, it had bean sprouts on it. Well, of course. This was L.A. He ate the sandwich mechanically, not really tasting it. He was screwed. There was nowhere to go from here. Tony had been right. He wasn't a field agent. He couldn't just hop on a plane, fly to a crime scene, and expect to spot some crucial clue that the local police and FBI forensics team had somehow missed. On the bedside table, his Virgil lit, telling him it was bad to the bone. That was probably Tony, calling to tell him what an idiot he was. At the moment, he was inclined to agree with her. The tiny screen didn't show Tony's face, however. It was Jay Gridley.
"What's up, Jay?"
"I think I got him, boss."
"What? How? Where?"
"I crunched all the commercial airline flights leaving SoCal in the last 12 hours, Burbank, LAX, John Wayne, and Orange County."
"And you found Ventura?"
"No, but I did find a Mr. B.W., Corona."
"I don't see."
"It's another freeway name, boss."
"Kind of a reach, isn't it?"
"Maybe not. Guy booked a ticket 2 days ago, a round trip to Seattle. He was originally scheduled for this evening, but he called and changed it to an earlier flight. Return is open-ended.
I don't see how that makes it any more certain.
Okay, look. He planned to leave tonight, but there was some kind of a problem, a shootout, so he had to take off early.
But he's planning to come back, your Mr. Corona.
If you're on the run, you don't buy a one-way ticket. That's a red flag, first thing cops look for.
But why would he use a name we might know?
Because he doesn't know the freeway names have been compromised. He doesn't know we picked up his pal at the surplus store in Washington. So why would he throw away perfectly good ID?
Still, sounds like a stretch.
Jay did an imitation of a late-night infomercial. But wait. Don't order yet. Listen to this. The Virgil screen was tiny, but it had good resolution, and Michaels could see Jay's grin easily enough. I checked the car rental places at SeaTac. A Mr. B.W. Corona walked into Avis, no reservation, and rented a mid-sized Dodge 10 minutes after the flight from L.A. landed late this afternoon. You got a computer terminal there in your room, boss?
Yes.
Plug your Virgil into it. I want to show you something.
Michaels opened the terminal, lit the screen, and tapped the infrared send and receive code into his Virgil. Jay's face appeared on the hotel's computer screen.
I got your visual on the hotel's computer, Michaels said.
Stand by. The image of Jay was replaced by a digital line-by-line image. It was a close-up of a California driver's license. This came from the counter scanner at Avis. They log all licenses.
The man in the hologram had short hair but a full beard. Could that be Ventura? Michaels couldn't tell.
I don't see the guy in our sketch.
No law against growing a beard, having your picture taken, then shaving. But forget the picture.
Michaels was already scanning the information on the license. He got no farther than the name.
Son of a bitch, why didn't you tell me this in the first place?
Come on, boss, you always save the best part of a story for last.
You want me to call the Washington State Police and have him picked up?
I suppose you know where he is, too, huh?
Sure.
Oh, really?
Jay laughed.
You are really going to love this part. Avis has theft recovery devices installed in their fleet. Somebody decides to keep a car instead of turning it in? They can dial a number and turn on a little broadcast unit wired into the car's battery. The unit sends a GPS signal to the nice folks at Brinks, and they can tell you exactly where the vehicle is. He shifted back into the infomercial announcer's voice. Now, how much would you pay?
Son of a bitch.
Michaels looked at the computer's flat screen. The name on the license was the final selling point. The BW stood for Bruce Wayne. And everybody who read comics, watched television cartoons, or went to action-adventure movies knew that Bruce Wayne was the secret identity of Batman, mentor and elder partner of Robin the Boy Wonder, a.k.a. Dick Grayson. If this wasn't the guy they wanted, it was one hell of a coincidence.
All right, Jay, I'm impressed. What will it take to get the car rental company to give us the tracking information?
Already done, boss. You want to guess where he's going?
Surprise me.
Jay laughed again. Port Townsend, Washington. It was almost 9 p.m. when Ventura rolled into the small tourist village of Port Townsend. Situated on a fat, semi-hook-shaped isthmus jutting into Puget Sound, the sleepy town had once upon a time been the gateway to the U.S. Northwest via the Straits of Juan de Fuca. Those glory days were long past, and now the tourists came to see some of the prime examples of Victorian-style houses left in the country. Ventura had been here in the daylight, and it looked almost as if somebody had gone back in time, grabbed a section of San Francisco just before the great earthquake of 1906, and dropped it up here. The main drag downtown was Water Street. Above downtown, overlooking a bluff, Lawrence Street was the parallel uptown road. From Lawrence Street, Taylor Street ran up the hill to Foster, which was where Morrison's house was. Morrison hadn't snagged one of the Victorian homes, but a more modest stone house built in the 1920s. After his reconnaissance patrol, Ventura found a restaurant still open and had a late supper. He took his time. It was after 10:45 p.m. when he left, having spoken to nobody but the waitress. At this time of night, given the lack of traffic, there was almost none, Ventura didn't drive past Morrison's house even once. If the Chinese had people watching, or if some laggard Fed had hung around, a car passing by would certainly be an object of interest. He knew where the house was, knew how to get there, and he would be a lot harder to spot on foot. He had made some purchases when he'd gotten here. There was a big grocery department store complex on the highway. He stopped there and bought black jeans, a black long-sleeve T-shirt, and a navy blue windbreaker. He'd changed clothes in a public restroom downtown, putting the new clothes on under his pale gray slacks and white shirt. He parked the car 5 blocks away from Morrison's, in a line of other cars at the curb. A rental car with Washington plates wouldn't exactly scream trouble. He had the Kunin under the windbreaker. It was chilly enough to justify a light jacket, if not 2 shirts and 2 pairs of pants. And he carried a set of lockpicks and spare magazines in one windbreaker pocket, a small flashlight in the other. Probably nobody would notice him at this hour. In his mind, he was B.W. Corona, married, 2 kids, up to meet his family for a holiday. He was staying at a local B&B down in town. He couldn't remember the name, but it was that big Victorian place on the corner, you know? And he was out walking because he couldn't sleep. Subterfuge was in the attitude. A cop might stop somebody skulking from shadow to shadow if he spotted him, but a tourist out walking had a different look, a different feel to him. Until he got closer to his destination, that was what Ventura was going to be, a tourist. A local cop would see nothing more. And when the bar started to close, that's probably where the local patrol car would be, looking for drunks. Once he was within a block or so of his destination, Ventura would shuck the white shirt and light slacks and become a ninja, part of the night. He would be invisible in the darkness, but if a cop did somehow miraculously see him, then it would be the cop's bad luck. At this stage of the game, he couldn't leave anybody behind to tell tales. He'd find a quiet spot and wait until it was late enough for the widow Morrison to get to sleep. Then he would move. The rental car waiting at the Port Townsend Airport was a 6-year-old Datsun that was badly in need of a tune-up. Only thing they had available, the guy from Rent-A-Beater had told him. Somebody had rented the good Dodge only half an hour earlier. The Datsun chugged and rattled along, ran ragged and nearly stalled several times. The dash GPS was broken, but there was a worn and greasy paper map in the glove box, and between that and his Virgil's GPS, Michaels was able to locate the address he wanted. He knew that Ventura had been headed here. Jay had gotten the GPS readings from Brinks, and Port Townsend wasn't really on the way to anywhere else, unless you planned to catch a ferry to the San Juan Islands. By 9, Ventura's rental car was in the town, and it was still here now at 11, but Michaels had to hurry. It wasn't that outlandish when you thought about it. This was where Dr. Morrison had lived, and within an hour of his estimated time of death, a man going under the name of Corona, who was in all likelihood the late doctor's bodyguard, had gotten on a plane headed this way. He could be going somewhere else in this town, that was true, but this was one more coincidence that didn't play. There must be something in Morrison's house that Ventura Corona wanted, something worth taking a hurried flight here for. And what did Morrison have of value? Well, that was pretty obvious. Maybe it was something else. Maybe he was coming here for some other reason entirely, but Michaels couldn't think of any offhand. Michaels could call the local police, get some backup from the county sheriff and maybe a few state police officers for good measure, surround Morrison's house and grab Ventura when he showed up. Simple. He could do that, but he didn't want to scare the guy off. If there were a dozen local cops tromping around this quiet little burg in the middle of the night, Ventura would have to be blind to miss them. So what Michaels had in mind was to find the house, hide somewhere he could watch it, and wait. When Ventura showed up, then he'd call in the cavalry. Give him time to find what he came for, maybe to save Net Force having to look for it themselves. If Ventura was already there, as soon as Alex saw him come out, he'd make the call. Ventura might be able to run, but he couldn't hide, not as long as he drove his rented car. And that car, according to Jay, was parked not far from here, and had been there for at least 15 minutes. Michael certainly didn't plan to try and take the guy down on his own. This was the man who had outshot John Howard, and the general was no slouch when it came to guns, a lot better than Michael's was. He didn't even have a gun with him, only the issue taser, and while that would knock a man on his ass with a single hit, you had to be pretty close to get that hit. He had no desire to go up against a highly skilled killer, who was certainly better armed and more desperate than he was. No. Michaels had a strike team in place, 5 minutes away, as close as they could get without risking alerting their quarry, ready to move on his signal. He'd watch, make sure the guy showed up, and then get all the help he needed. At least NetForce would get partial credit for the capture. And if they were lucky, maybe the workings of the mind control ray as a bonus. That would go a long way to making up for all the mistakes. He looked at the map. He was still a couple of miles away. Might as well make the call he'd been putting off. He pushed the button for Tony's phone. Her message came on before even one ring. Hey, you've reached Tony Fiorella. Leave a message and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. He frowned. Was she not taking any calls or just not taking his calls? Well, okay, it was the middle of the night here, so it was the wee hours in D.C. Maybe she was just asleep and had turned off the ringer. Tony, it's me, just calling to see how you're doing. Well, look, I'm sorry about everything. I'll be back in town tomorrow. Let's sit down and talk about it, okay? We can work all this out. He thumbed the discom button, tucked the Virgil back onto his belt. After he collected Ventura, that would give Tony something she could pass along to her new boss. Ventura had studied the overview maps his ops had done of the neighborhood when he'd taken on Morrison as a client. He knew as much about the houses and inhabitants for a block in either direction as a team of good surveillance ops could learn in a short time. He knew which houses had dogs, which houses had kids, which houses had night owls who stayed up watching vids until all hours. And fortunately, there weren't a lot of any of these close to Morrison's. So it was that Ventura now sat in the backyard of the house behind Morrison's, nestled into a gap between a small metal utility shed and a couple of cords of firewood. From the look of it, the wood was fir, alder, and madrona, a good combination. The fir, when dry, would burn very quickly. The alder could be used without seasoning, and the madrona would burn longer and hotter than oak once it got going. Odd, the things you learned along the way. Ventura glanced at his watch. Almost 12:30. The lights had been off in Morrison's house for more than an hour, so the widow was likely asleep by now. What was her name? Yes, Shannon. That sounded like the name of a teenage starlet or somebody who was a cheerleader for some NFL football team. Hardly the name one would connect to a scientist who had been twice her age. Ventura looked around carefully. It was quiet, cool, and he hadn't seen anything to worry him as he sneaked to this hiding place. If there were other watchers here, they must be working the street out front. Good and bad, that. If they were there, he hadn't been able to see them, which meant they were adept. Then again, if they were out front, they wouldn't see him as he went to the back door. He took several deep breaths, inhaling and letting them out slowly, oxygenating his blood, trying to relax. He would go at one. Michaels had left his beat-up Datsun at the bottom of the hill, half a block away from where Ventura's rental was parked, and hiked up toward Morrison's house. It had been a while since he'd done any covert surveillance in the field, a long while, and his skills were not as sharp as he would have liked. A lot of it came back as he worked his way toward his target. He used trees for cover, went through backyards when possible, kept low, listened carefully for dogs. He moved steadily when he left cover, and he stayed in the shadows as much as possible. That nobody seemed to notice him was probably more a testament to the hour than any real skill on his part, but hey, he'd take it. His hormones were flowing pretty good, too. He sometimes had to remember to breathe. He had remembered to shut the ringer off on his Virgil. It wouldn't do to be skulking in the bushes somewhere and suddenly start chiming out bad to the bone. As he drew closer to the house, Michaels wondered exactly what he was going to do once he got there. He knew that Ventura's rental car was still parked down the hill, so unless he missed him in passing, he was out here on foot somewhere, maybe already in the house. There was a street light up ahead on the right. Michaels crossed the road to stay in the darkness. 1 a.m., straight up, time to go. Ventura ran in a crouch toward the back door. It was only a 10 or 12 second trip, but it seemed to last for hours. He kept expecting to feel the impact of a bullet in the back, even though he knew that wasn't likely. There was no point in shooting him on the way in. The trip ended. The bullet had not come. He tried the doorknob, locked, and the deadbolt would also be locked if Shannon had been doing what her husband told her. Ventura took the leather pouch with his lockpicks and torsion tools from his jacket. The button lock on the doorknob would be a snap, and that was all he needed. He had a key for the deadbolt, since his people had overseen that lock's installation. He put the torsion tool into the key slot on the doorknob, used a triple triangle pick to rake the pins. Might as well try it the easy way first, before picking each tumbler separately. The torsion tool rotated the barrel mechanism on the second rake, maybe 6 seconds from start to finish. Ventura grinned. He still had the touch. He slipped the key into the deadbolt, turned it, and came up from his crouch as he opened the door and stepped into the hallway that led to the basement and the kitchen. He closed the door silently behind him. The alarm keypad was on the wall just past the light switch. He could see the red on diode gleaming. The only other light was from instrument glows in the kitchen. No help this far away. So he flicked on the flashlight and covered most of the lens with one hand, allowing only enough illumination to see the keypad. He punched in the four-digit number, 1986, the year Shannon had been born. Morrison had said she wasn't very good at remembering numbers, so he wanted to keep it simple. 1986. Ventura had shoes older than that. The hard part was done. The master bedroom was upstairs, and the living room study was just on the other side of the kitchen dining room. That was as far as he needed to go. If he didn't bump into the furniture or sneeze, the young widow would likely continue her beauty rest. He'd reset the alarm and relock the door when he left. Shannon would never know he'd been here. He moved through the kitchen. There was enough ambient light from the digital LCD clocks on the stove, microwave oven, and coffee maker for him to keep the flashlight lens covered completely. He didn't like to use a flashlight on a hot prowl. It was a dead giveaway to anybody who might be passing by or watching a place. Unless there was a power outage, residents normally didn't move around in their own houses using flashlights. But he didn't want to use the overheads or a lamp in here either. Watchers would, at the very least, be alerted that somebody was up and about. And some people had a hypersensitivity to light even when they slept. It was as if they could somehow feel the pressure of the photons on their bodies, although they couldn't see them. It wouldn't do for young Shannon to come yawning and padding down the stairs in her birthday suit, wondering who'd left the lights on. If she saw him, it would have to be the last thing she saw. And while killing her didn't bother him per se, finding her corpse would give the authorities pause to wonder why it had happened. Whoever had done it must have wanted something, they'd figure, and Ventura reasoned they would figure out what pretty quick. Right now, they didn't know that Morrison had passed on anything to anybody. Best to keep it that way until he was in a safe harbor. He let a thin ray of the flashlight peek from between his closed fingers as he stepped into the dining room, just enough to avoid the furniture. He crouched low and duck-walked toward the study. There was what he wanted, just ahead and to the right. Michaels was prone in a clump of bushes across the street to the east side of Morrison's house. The plants were evergreens, big junipers of some kind, trimmed into windblown bonsai shapes, but thick enough to crouch beneath and be mostly covered. He had worked his way there through the yard from the east, so he hadn't been visible from the street or, he hoped, Morrison's house. He had just gotten settled when he saw the man all in black scurry in a crouch to the back door. That must be Ventura. A minute later and I would have missed him. The man fiddled with the lock, and in what seemed no time at all, he'd opened the door and slipped inside. Either the door had been unlocked, or this guy was an expert with picks. Long ago, Michaels had covered that in his training, picking locks. But it had taken him half an hour to open even simple locks, and complicated ones were beyond him. His teacher had told him it was a thing of feel, that you either had the touch or you didn't. If you didn't, you could get better, but you'd never be a master at it. Well, enough ruminating on old training classes. Time to call in the Marines. Michaels pulled his Virgil from his belt and hit the button. 5 minutes tops and the cavalry would arrive. All he had to do was remain alert until they showed up. Unless his young wife had unknown sensibilities, Morrison had been quite the classical music fan. A CD-DVD rack above the Philips Technics R&P held a couple hundred titles. The titles tended to favor the Baroque composers, Bach, Handel, Vivaldi, Telemann, Heineken, Corelli, and Haydn, and Pachelbel, of course. Fortunately, the man had been meticulous in his cataloging. The titles were alphabetized, so it took only a few seconds to find the DVD Ventura wanted, Pachelbel's greatest hit. He grinned up the name and turned the case over. The disc was a compilation, several versions and variations of the contrapuntal melody Canon in D, a total playing time of 41 minutes 30 seconds. You'd have to be a real fan to listen to what was essentially the same simple tune played over and over again for that long. He opened the case to make certain the disc inside matched the title, and the silvery disc gave off a rainbow gleam in the flashlight's narrow beam. The markings looked genuine to Ventura, the little RCA dog and gramophone, the cut titles and numbers. Maybe an expert could tell the difference. He couldn't. Put this disc into an audio player, and you would get 40-plus minutes of variations on a musical theme. Put it into a computer, and look in the right spot using the right binary decoder, and you would get something else. Between the end of Canon of the Three Stars by Isao Tomita and the Plasma Symphony Orchestra, and the beginning of Pachelbel, Canon in D, by the Baroque Chamber Orchestra, led by Ettore Strata, if Morrison had been telling the truth, lay a secret the Chinese had been willing to pay nearly $500 million to get their hands on. He grinned again, put the disc back into the case, and slipped it into his inside windbreaker pocket. He looked up the stairs. No sounds drifted down from the sleeping widow. Good. Always good to avoid complications when possible. He retraced his steps to the back door. He keyed in the alarm code, cracked the door open a hair, and set the button lock on the door. He had 30 seconds to close the door behind him before the alarm kicked on. It only took one of those seconds for him to draw his pistol and slip the safety off. If somebody had been watching him, it made more sense for them to wait until he left with whatever he had come for before they took him down. Otherwise, they might never find it, if somebody was watching. He held the pistol down by his leg. He took a deep breath, released half of it, and stepped outside. Michaels was watching the house when the whole situation suddenly changed. Whatever Ventura had gone into the house for, either he knew where it was or he'd changed his mind, Michaels thought. He was in and out in maybe 2 minutes, and the cavalry was still at least 3 minutes away. Michaels watched as the man did something one-handed with the deadbolt lock. Save for a quick glance, he did it without looking at the door. Instead, he scanned the yard, his gaze sweeping back and forth, seeking. His other hand was hidden behind his leg. Even though he knew he was pretty much invisible on the ground under the bushes across the street, Michaels froze. His pucker factor went right off the scale. Ventura finished his manipulation with the door's lock, glanced around again, and started across the backyard. Michaels gathered himself to get up. He was going to follow Ventura come hell or high water, but he was going to be real careful doing it. His hand hovered over the call button on his Virgil, but he didn't press it. Hitting the distress signal now would bring the cavalry with full lights and sirens, and he still couldn't risk alerting Ventura. He was on his hands and knees and about to crawl out from under the evergreen when two men stepped out from behind the shed and pointed guns at Ventura. "Hold it right there," one of them began. He never finished the sentence. There were several bright flashes and terrific explosions, and all three men went down. But Ventura rolled up, hardly even slowing, ran to the two fallen men, and fired his pistol twice more. It all happened so fast and unexpectedly, Michaels wasn't sure what he had seen, but his brain raced to fill it in. Two men with guns braced Ventura, who was either the fastest draw who ever lived, or he already had his own gun out. One, two, three shots, yes. Three. Two from Ventura, one from one of the dead guys. And they were surely dead, because Ventura sprinted over and put one more round into each one. Looked like the heads, but it was hard to be sure about that. The after images from the first shots had washed out Michael's vision some, and Ventura didn't stop to examine the parried shot. He took off at a run, straight to the street. Michael scrambled from under the bushes and followed, but he stayed crouched, using cover. He did not want Ventura to look back and see him, no, not after that display. Not only was the man a killer,
He was expert at it. To take out two men with guns already pointed at you, that was either great skill or great luck, and Michaels didn't want to test either. Lights started to go on in houses along the street. They probably didn't get a lot of gunfire up here on a weeknight. No, probably not. Michaels ran on the darker side of the street, and he had his taser in his hand. He hoped he wouldn't have to get close enough to Ventura to have to use it. Ventura smiled to himself as he ran. He did a tactical reload, changing magazines, dropping the one missing three shots into his windbreaker pocket. Those had probably been Chinese agents. Feds would have yelled out their ID, and there would have been more of them. Speed was the most important thing now. Gunfire in a quiet neighborhood would wake people up. Somebody would call the police, and even if they were slow, it would only be a few minutes before cops got here. He'd have a little while longer before the locals unraveled things, enough time to get clear of the city, but he had to figure they might have spotted him earlier, noticed his car, so a different vehicle was going to be necessary. The sooner he found one, the better. He was going to have to get rid of this Coonan, too. He hadn't had time to stop and pick up his expended brass here, and this gun already had two shootings on it, in Alaska and in California. Under better circumstances, he would have dropped the pistol into a lake or ocean after the first time he'd used it, but there simply hadn't been time. Only a fool would hold on to something that would get him the death penalty if he was caught with it. He had other guns, and as soon as he could get to them, he'd lose this one. There was an old pickup truck parked on the street half a block ahead of him. That would do. He could break the window, get inside, crack the ignition for a hot wire, be gone in another 2 minutes. He glanced behind him. No sign of pursuit, no men chasing him with guns. Maybe those were the only two. Maybe. But even as he ran, that part of him that feasted on danger grinned and smacked its chops, looking for more. There was nothing like an adrenaline rush, the immediate sense of danger and possible death. He should be afraid, but what he felt was closer to orgasm than fear. He had the prize. He was on his way. Enemies were down. All around him, life was crystalline, razor sharp, throbbing with triumph. He lived. They died. It didn't get any better than this. Here was the truck. Try the door. Ha! Not even locked. He reached up over the visor just in case, and lo, the keys. He laughed aloud. No, it couldn't get any better than this. He put the gun down on the seat and shoved the key into the ignition slot.
Going somewhere, Colonel?
Surprised, Ventura jumped, started to grab the Coonan.
Don't! You won't make it!
Ventura froze. He looked up. Standing 6 feet away, a shotgun aimed at Ventura's head was General Jackson Bull Smith, smiling. This was not in Ventura's game plan.
General, odd running into you here.
Not odd at all, Luther. Me and a few of the boys have been waiting for you to show up.
Those two were yours?
They were.
Sorry.
Don't worry about it. They got what they deserved. It was a bonehead move going at you face on.
Smith smiled again, and the shotgun didn't waver a hair. Ventura was looking right down the muzzle. 12-gauge, he noted. Modified choke.
There were a pair of other guys here before us. Commie agents, near as we could tell, but they went away.
I thought there might be. Thanks.
Don't thank me yet. I had a couple other boys tailing you, but you lost them after that mess in Los Angeles. Lost your client, too. That's a real shame. Figured you'd show up here sooner or later.
You continue to surprise me, General.
How? Because there are better surveillance gadgets than the ones you had in your car at the compound, that's how. You think because we live up in the woods and stomp around in the bear shit we don't have access to modern technology? You get a flunking grade for underestimating folks, Luther. Especially your friends. You should have cut me in instead of trying to bullshit me with that story of yours.
Ventura smiled and shook his head.
I sit corrected, General. Real impressive work. Not too late to make amends, is it?
I'm afraid it is, Colonel. I'm afraid it is.
When he saw the man with the shotgun point the weapon at Ventura where he sat in the truck, he was presumably going to steal. Michael slid into a front yard and behind a thick-boled Douglas fir tree. He was across the street, and they were busy enough with each other that they hadn't noticed him. Reaching down, he hit the alarm button on his Virgil. It would take them a minute or two to react.
but he was no longer worried about alerting Ventura.
Now what? Who was this guy? Was he connected to the two dead men at Morrison's? What the hell was going on?
Michaels was 60, 70 feet away, and the taser was accurate for 15 or 20 feet, if you were lucky. But he'd only get one shot, and then he'd have to reload. And as John Howard and Julio Fernandez had pointed out to him, the fastest taser reloader in the world could not outpace a handgun with multiple rounds. NetForce computer and management people were supposed to be desk jockeys. They didn't need guns. That's what the military arm was for. If he got out of this alive, Michaels planned to start carrying a real gun. Yeah. Unfortunately, the military arm was not here. He didn't have a real gun, and a taser was what he did have. So, who to shoot? Assuming he could get close enough to shoot either one of them. He couldn't hear what they were saying to each other, but he was able to hear what the shotgunner said next because he said it loudly.
Bubba!
A shaven-headed bodybuilder in dark camo approached the truck from the passenger side, a long-barreled pistol in his hands. He was careful not to come in straight on, but angled slightly from the back. Good move. That would keep him out of the shotgunner's line of fire if things started cooking. Nothing like another little complication to make his life harder. Even if he'd had an assault rifle instead of the taser. Michaels didn't like those odds, and he didn't know who these new players were. In theory, they might even be on his side. Maybe he should wait a second and see what happened before he stood up and commanded everybody to drop their weapons. Maybe a couple of seconds. Ventura felt the adrenaline pop and bubble in him. Heard its siren song calling him to action. You're invincible, it said. Nobody has ever been able to beat you. You're the best there ever was. Kill them.
All right, Smith said. Here is how it's gonna go. You give me whatever it was you came here to collect. Then you can be on your way. Your life for the data. I figure that's an even trade. If anything that looks like a weapon comes out of your pocket, we take what we want off your body. This pump's carrying 8 rounds of number 4 buckshot. I don't have to tell you what that will do to your face at this range.
No.
Smith might not be a real general, but he had been a real soldier, and he did have a shotgun pointed at him. Bubba, on the other side of the truck, had a handgun. But if Bubba fired first, he would have to shoot through the glass, and his angle might partially deflect the bullet. If Ventura ducked suddenly, Smith would probably pull the trigger, and with any luck, the charge of BBs would go right over his head and through the passenger window. It would take half a second for Smith to rack the slide for a second shot, and while a full-sized American pickup truck's door would not stop a deer or sabot slug from a 12-gauge, it would stop a load of number 4 buck, or most of it. Ventura weighed his chances. This was it. He had assessed the situation as best he could. As soon as he handed over the disc, he was a dead man anyway. Smith couldn't let him walk away and expect to sleep nights, because sooner or later he'd know that Ventura would come for him. And a wire enclosure full of men playing soldier wouldn't be enough protection. Smith knew that. The only reason he didn't shoot him now was to make sure he had the data, and to find out what he could about it. Here was the moment. No past, no future. Be here now. He smiled and made his decision, the only one he could make.
All right, General. We'll play it your way.
But as fast as he could move, Ventura ducked and grabbed for his pistol. As it sometimes did when things turned violently dangerous, time narrowed and slowed. Michaels saw Ventura disappear from sight, and the blast of the shotgun was a tremendous boom immediately after that. Bubba fired his pistol, a thin and almost quiet crack, crack, and two holes appeared in the truck's windshield. Somehow, amazed at himself, Michaels found himself on his feet running toward the shooting, his tiny, insignificant taser stretched out in front of himself at arm's length. Ventura's hand came up inside the truck like a periscope, a pistol in it, and he fired at the shotgunner, twisted and fired at Bubba, blam, blam, that quick. The shotgunner went down, hitting the body. But Bubba had dodged as soon as Ventura's pistol had come up, and he fired his own gun wildly, 6, 8 times. It sounded almost like a full auto, one continuous crack, 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 and it must have run empty because it stopped. Ventura sat up and he shoved his pistol toward the shotgunner, but the man rolled and came up and pointed the shotgun at Ventura again and fired. Michael saw Ventura take the blast in the chest and bang into the steering wheel, but he managed to get off another shot that seemed to hit the shotgunner without major effect. The shotgunner let go a third blast. Ventura disappeared from view. Michaels realized he was screaming as the shotgunner turned his head and stared at him in surprise. He started to bring the shotgun around, and it was too far for a taser shot, but Michael triggered the thing anyway. Twin silvery needles lanced at the shotgunner. He could see the electric darts, but they hit the shotgun, one in the butt, one in the forestock, and that wouldn't do shit. The shotgun's muzzle came around slowly, slowly. And it was almost lined up when the shooter realized Michaels was about to barrel into him at a dead run, so he fired. Too soon. The blast went past Michael's right ear. He felt a tug and a quick burn, but that was all, and then he slammed into the shooter at a dead run, and they both went down. The impact stunned them both, but Michaels recovered first. He rolled up and kicked at the other man's head. He missed, but caught a shoulder as the shotgunner tried to roll away. The shotgun was on the street, 5 yards down the hill. Michaels was aware that Bubba was on the other side of the truck, probably reloading his pistol, and that he didn't have time to fool around here. The shotgunner came up, groggy, hands raising in a defensive posture, and Michaels didn't wait but leaped in and snapped his elbow right at the man's temple as hard as he could. There was a damp snap, and the man went down bonelessly limp. But Bubba was coming around the front of the truck, Bubba and his pistol, and Michaels knew he was screwed. He was going to die. Somebody flew out of nowhere and slammed into Bubba from behind, knocking his pistol loose as he went to one knee. His attacker dived and rolled up 2 yards past Bubba, spun to face him. Michael stared, unable to believe what he saw.
Tony?
The big man went down to his knee, and she had too much momentum to stop, so Tony stretched out into a shoulder roll, hit the road hard enough to clack her teeth together, but came up mostly unhurt. Shoulder was going to be real sore, assuming she survived that long. The big man was up, coming at her. He swung a punch that would have flattened a horse had it hit, a hard right cross. Tony ducked, double-tapped the man's thick and muscular arm with her left palm and right backhand, used the momentum of the second tap to cock her elbow and stepped in at an angle to her left. He was too big to meet head-on, then slammed her right elbow into his ribs. She felt the ribs go, heard him grunt and slow his advance a little, but it wasn't enough to stop him. He kept coming. He was too big, too strong. If he grabbed her, that would be bad. Too close for the foot sweep. She had to use her thigh. She caught his upper leg with hers, snapped her knee upward, and shoved with her right hand at his belt line. The seesaw lever worked. He lost his balance and sprawled face down on the street, hands outstretched to absorb his fall. Tony followed him. When he lifted his head, she kicked for his chin, but he fell away and blocked at the same time, and her shin met his left forearm bone. His arm was weaker. The ulna snapped. Damn, he was tough. He grabbed at her foot, missed when she dodged back, and used the grab's moment to regain his feet. He jumped in again and fired a hard straight punch using his good right arm. Tony was in the zone, fighting in a righteous rage, no longer thinking, blending with her attacker. She punched her right fist at his head, stretched out over his punch and blocked with her left at the same time, deflecting his arm just behind the elbow. Her punch hit his ear, no big impact, but she was in position for the putar kapala, the head twist. She scooped inside his right elbow with her left hand, caught his neck with her right and circled her hands, left up, right down, pulling them close into her body as she dropped her weight. The motion twisted him around clockwise and she grabbed his head with both hands. A twist alone was a neck crank, painful but not damaging. A twist and a pull, putting an arch in his back, was a break. She twisted sharply counterclockwise and pulled at the same time. The sound of the vertebrae cracking seemed louder to her than the shotgun blast had been. The man fell. He might survive, but he wasn't going to be getting up on his own. Not now, and maybe never again. The fury left her as she turned, looking for more opponents. There were none. Only Alex standing over the downed shotgunner, staring at her in amazement. Sirens approached, growing louder, and neither of them could find words. Finally, as the flashing lights of the first police car strobed them, Alex said, "What the hell are you doing here?" "Nobody moves," a cop nervously clutching his pistol yelled. "No problem." Alex and Tony stood very still, and nobody else there could have moved anyway. The sleepy little scenic tourist town was certainly wide awake up on the hillside now. City police, firemen, deputies, and most of the neighbors all stood in the glow of headlights and emergency flashers, trying to figure out what was going on. It was noisy, bright, and hectic. It didn't take all that long to get it sorted out. Michaels explained who he and Tony were, and when their NetForce FBI identification checked out valid, that made things a lot less tense. There were two dead men in Morrison's backyard, and their IDs indicated that they were members of some paramilitary group based in Idaho. The shotgunner was alive, with a fractured skull, and it seemed he was the leader of that same group, a general. He had been hit twice by bullets from Ventura's pistol, both of which had been stopped by his body armor. Bubba, the bodybuilder, had a broken neck. And Ventura? He had taken two blasts from the general's shotgun, and unfortunately for him, he hadn't been wearing body armor. The first shot apparently hit him in the chest, the second in the face. Either would have killed him, the fireman paramedic said, the headshot faster than the one in the pump. Michaels and Tony went through Ventura's personal property. He had the gun, extra ammunition, flashlight, lockpicks, car keys, and, inside what was left of his windbreaker pocket, a DVD disc inside a plastic case. Both had been shattered into tiny bits by the shotgun blast, some slivers of which had been driven into the dead man's heart by the impact. "Want to bet that disc is what he stopped by Morrison's to find?" Tony said.
"No bet," Michael said. "You think the FBI lab could put this thing back together?"
Some of the bloody pieces were the size of needles. She shook her head. "Enough to retrieve whatever was on it? I doubt it. If the secret to the crazy ray was on that disc, it's gone." Michaels nodded.
"Probably just as well. I'm not sure I'd want our government getting its hands on it any more than anybody else."
He looked at her.
"You're the one who got the good car from the rental place, aren't you? Just before I got there."
"Yes."
"How did you know where to find me? Was it Jay?"
"No. You left a public trail.
You weren't trying to hide. I'm not totally inept on the net." "Why did you come?"
She looked at him. "Are you sorry I did?" He shook his head.
"I'd have to be a fool to say that, given the circumstances. I can't remember the last time I was so glad to see somebody as when you knocked Bubba down. Thank you."
"I was acting in my capacity as liaison, you know."
"Uh-huh.
Why are you so pig-headed, Alex? You know that I love you, and you love me just as much."
"Yeah."
"It was going bad for us, and work was the problem. You know that, too. I'd rather lose the job than the relationship." He nodded.
"Yeah. Me too."
She looked at the fireman hauling away Ventura's body. "It's going to be a long night before we're done here. Do you have a place to stay?"
"No.
I've got a room at a bed and breakfast at the far end of town. What say we go there and take a long nap when this is done?"
He thought about it for a second. She was right. He did love her. And he would rather save their personal relationship than either of their jobs. He gave her a small grin. "Okay," he said. "You twisted my arm."
Friday, July 29th, 2011. Michaels walked into the condo, saw that the snail mail was on the table in the kitchen.
"Tony," he yelled, "you home?"
"In here."
"Where is here?"
"The living room." He walked into the room. She was sitting on the couch folding towels. "I dried the laundry," she said. "You mixed the dark towels with the light ones again."
"What can I say? I'm evil through and through. Shoot me."
He moved to where she sat, bent, and kissed her.
"How was your day?"
"Not bad. I had to do a presentation on what a wonderful job NetForce is doing for Senator Bogle's staff."
"Sounds easy enough."
"Balancing a dozen spinning plates on the end of sticks sounds easy, Alex. Since I left, NetForce has trouble finding its ass with both hands."
He laughed. "Got any plans for supper?"
I could microwave some burritos. How about I order Chinese takeout, my treat?
Fine by me.
He took a deep breath. It had been on his mind a lot lately, how to do this, and he was nervous about it.
Listen, he began. Things have been working out okay for us lately, haven't they?
You have to ask?
No, I mean, I think they have, but I don't want to take anything for granted. We're okay, aren't we? I mean, we're doing all right on a personal level, right?
Except for you mixing the darks with the lights in the wash, we're terrific. He nodded. Here was the hard part. She stopped folding the towels.
What is it, Alex? Something's on your mind. Tell me.
He sat down on the couch next to her.
Okay, look, I'm not the most romantic guy in the world, but do you want to get married?
Her eyes got wide and she grinned. Yes, of course.
He blew out a big sigh.
Good. You thought I would turn you down?
I hope not. I didn't want to think too much about that.
She grabbed him and hugged him and they kissed. She broke it and leaned back.
Anyways, it was about time you got around to asking me, she said.
Yeah? You could have asked me, you know.
Nope. I'm an old-fashioned girl. That's the man's job.
Old-fashioned, you? He laughed. You're a butt-kicking, hard-headed woman who looks over my shoulder at work.
Oh, well, you won't have to worry about that much longer.
He looked at her.
How come?
I'm going to quit work.
What?
I intended to keep the job when I took it, but something better has come up.
A better job? It's not too far away, is it? I was just getting used to having you around.
Oh, don't worry. I'll be around.
She put her hands over his shoulders, then slid them up behind his neck.
This job is going to be something completely different.
Yeah? What?
I'm going to become a full-time mommy.
He stared at her, stunned.
You're...
Yep,
she said, grinning like a fool.
I'm pregnant.
Then, they were both grinning like fools.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. That's 1-800-331-3761. Thank you.